Okay, we might kick it off since it looks like everyone's here. So just setting up the process going forward, Cole's going to talk for about 25 minutes or so, and then we'll leave it open for questions. Would you prefer that people wait to the end?
Yeah,
so if we just wait for the end of the presentation, then we can ask questions then. There'll be plenty of time. I'm going to remind him when it gets to about 20 minutes, so we should have time. If I can just ask that we ask the questions in the middle there, and we'll kick it off. So I've known Colin for a number of years. So he has recently joined RGA as Deputy Pricing Actuary and heads up their research division. He worked for TAL prior to that for about 12 years,
yes.
Which probably is about how long I've known Colin as well. And he's worked in a variety of roles, so pricing and valuation there as well as capital and so on, and was most recently a Senior Product Actuary in the group area, so hence the topic today. And Colin's also worked both here and in the UK and has a varied experience across both of those. So welcome, Colin. Thank
Thanks, you. Catherine. Welcome and thank you for attending my presentation on the Winners Curse and Group Risk. So today I'm going to try and cover sort of a reasonable amount of the material that's in my paper. So first of all, we'll go, what is it all about? What is the Winners Curse? Then I'll introduce a simple model which sort of demonstrates the effect of the Winner's Curse in a simple example. Talk about what may influence the extent of it, sources of risk and uncertainty that feed into it, and then talk about what we can learn about it going forward. So I thought I'd start my talk with this quote, which was earlier this year from Warren Buffett. So there are lots of ways to lose money in insurance, and the industry never ceases searching for new ones. So I think the message behind this is insurance itself is a very complex business, and if you're not wary and look out for traps, then you can certainly fall into them, and Winner's Curse is potentially one of those. So moving on, here we have a jar of coins. So this is a classic example that's used to introduce the concept of a Winner's Curse. So assume the current jar of coins is up for auction, and nobody knows the actual value of that jar of coins, and you have a number of bidders bidding for it. If all the bidders put in their expected value for that jar of coins, some of those bids will be above the value of the jar and some will be below the value of the jar. And if the winner goes to the highest bid, then that bid is most likely to be above the value of the jar and hence they'll actually make a loss. And that, in essence, is the winner's curse. So, moving on, what if all bidders take this into account? Then they obviously need to adjust their bids knowing that everybody's bidding the expected value, but how much do they actually reduce their bid by? The average value of the bids will undoubtedly be below the expected value of the jar, but some are likely to still be above the value of the jar and still make a loss. This is essentially the situation you can find yourself in group risk tenders. Moving on, just a quick overview of group risk pricing for those not actually familiar with it. So insurance group risk schemes generally work on a three-year renewal basis, where they're tendered about approximately every 3 years through a tender process. Group risk premiums for a fund need to cover the claims cost, expenses, and profits. So in a tender, you're given information about the past claims and past premiums, and from that, you need to estimate what the future claims might be, and obviously, you then load up for things like expenses and profit. In it, you need to deal with things like poor data, claim delays, changing membership, changing product design as well. So there's lots of variables that go into it. Moving on to our simple model. So this is the simple model is we have a tender for a group risk scheme. The current price of that group risk scheme is 100. The expected claim cost of that scheme is 85, and that is unknown. So it's only expected claim cost, and it's not known to the market. So the expected loss ratio is the claims divided by the premiums or the price, and that's 85%. Next, we assume that each insurer can estimate the expected loss, can produce an unbiased estimate of the expected loss ratio, and that the distribution of those estimates has a standard error of 10% around that expected claim ratio. So here you see on the graph that the bell curve or the normal curve is the distribution of those estimates from the insurance company's tendering, and you can see some sample estimates down at the bottom. Next, so assuming that the the tender goes to the lowest loss, to whoever produces the lowest loss ratio. The red curve is then the distribution of the lowest loss ratio. And as you can see, it is well below the expected loss ratio. So this is the curve where you have six insurers bidding for a scheme. And then the red line is actually the mean of the expected lowest loss ratio. So this is produced through simulating sort of multiple tenders. So if an insurer was to... So the loss ratio in here is 74.2%, so it's well below the 85%. If an insurer was to base their price upon that loss ratio, experienced loss ratio, they would have a price of 87.3, assuming they had a 15% profit margin. And then their future loss ratio would expect to be 97.3%, so well above what they would want. So this is one example. So if we move along to actually changing some of the variables, so this is where the number of companies actually vary. So the first one is first... Top row is where there's one company, and it's a non-competitive situation. So in this situation, the expected loss ratio is close to the 85%, and they expect to make their average margin. As you introduce more and more companies to the tender process, the actual average winning price falls quite rapidly. So even introducing one company reduces it by 5%. Four companies, you've actually reduced the winning price by about 10%. So you can see it's got quite a dramatic impact. We then have a look at, for the situation with six companies, we then have a look at what happens when you have a look at different standard errors to the pricing. So here we've got the range of standard errors from 6% to 15%, and obviously a lot of things can actually influence that standard error. So you can see it's a relatively linear relationship. As the standard error increases, the average winning price will decrease. Finally, we look at, in terms of for the simple model, we look at what happens when one of those, up until now we've been dealing with identical insurers. We now look at the situation where what happens if one of those insurers is different. And the situation we look at here is if they've got more accurate or less accurate pricing ability. So we measure that by the sort of the standard error of their pricing. So the situation where that first company has the standard error of 10% as all the other insurers is where the points meet. So that's the 10%. So everybody's got the same market share, which is one metric we've got here, and every company's got the same margin. As that one company gets to improve their pricing, so their standard error falls, their market share actually reduces dramatically because they're less likely to produce have the lowest price. And similarly, their margin actually increases, but it never goes up to 15%, which is still their target profit margin. So they still never achieve their target profit margin, but they do much better than the other companies. So the red is essentially the average market share and margin for the other companies. As their standard error of that company increases, so their pricing becomes less accurate, and this is still unbiased pricing, by the way, so they're still producing an estimate of the best estimate loss ratio, just not as accurately. Their margin, their market share tends to increase an awful lot, but their, as you can see, their margin just falls dramatically as well, and it's not long before they're actually making losses. So you can see that being able to price more accurately or less accurately actually has a big impact on how you perform in the market. Now, what determines, I guess, that range of standard error? So here we'll have a look at, one component of this is parameter risk, and I'll just read out the definition I've chosen here. So the correct application of sensible methods and calculations will not accurately reflect the underlying distribution of possible ultimate claims outcomes. As a result of a combination of data errors, sample errors, and an inappropriate fit of models, the definition of parameter uncertainty also includes the differences in best estimate between two reasonable actuaries using the same data and allows for their different judgments in responding to features of the data in their modelling and parameterisation. What this is sort of saying is that your best estimate is not a point estimate at all. It's an estimate within a range of reasonable estimates that other actuaries might choose as well. So If you had two actuaries that come up with different values, neither is necessarily wrong. They've just got different estimates. So let's go back to our jar of coins. So we could just take a straight out guess at what it is, but there are actually different methods we could actually use to value the jar of coins. First one is we could use volume. So we could get out a ruler, measure how the volume of it, and multiply it by an average cost per cubic centimetre. We could use weight, so we could weigh it, and again we can multiply it by an average weight per kilogram. We might have a sample of jars we've seen before. And again we could sort of say, well, that jar looks a bit like that jar, so it'll roughly have the same value, and we use that. Or we could look at new methods like an X-ray of the jar and work it out from that way. So group risk is really no different again. There's lots of different ways we can actually measure the expected claims. And these are all variables that go into our model. So I won't list them all, but there's a lot more than is on that slide. So you've got things around interpretation of data, choice of experience period, identifying trends, the use of judgment. There's an awful lot that goes into group risk pricing, where you could neither might be right, neither might be wrong. So how do we actually measure this? How can we actually measure the size of this parameter risk? There's a few different ways we could do it. So we could analyse past tenders and measure, see what the range of prices that have been generated have been. Some of us might have some experience of this and get an idea of what the possible range could be. We can build a bottom-up view by studying each of the components that go into the calculation and see what the impact of different choices in those models might be. Or we could introduce the control cycle and compare the actual outcome from what was expected from when it was priced. That one's a little bit difficult because you need to separate out stochastic risk. It's not just parameter risk that's in there, you've also got stochastic risk. So an example of one of those, there was a paper by Blumson and Laufer who surveyed 52 general insurance actuaries in the US to get their estimate of IBNR. So they sent out a set of sample data to get their estimates, and I think 51 of them came back. And the result of that was the mean of those samples was 30%, the standard deviation of the IBNR was 30% that came back. You can see there's a few outliers there, but most of them are distributed in here, sort of with a central estimate around that 30,000. But there's still quite a range if you have a look at that. The standard deviation of the mean in terms of total claim costs was just over 5%. So it's quite material. Another way we can do it is build up the bottom-up approach. So I'll go through an example of one component in building a bottom-up approach. So when we determine IBNRs, there's actually two ways we could possibly do it using a chain ladder method. So we could use a chain ladder method using claim counts times the average sum insured, or we could use a chain ladder method using actual claim amounts. So what I did is I simulated a hypothetical scheme which calculated the IBNR using these two different methods, and here are the results. So this is a scheme with this is a sample scheme with about 100,000 members in it, and I've got 10 years of worth of experience in here. So here the mean of that sample is coming out. This is the actual ultimate claims from that simulation. The mean's coming out at about 30 million, and you can see how it's distributed because no two simulations are the same. So it's close to a normal distribution. So you've got the classic bell curve there. From the reported claims that were within that simulation, I then calculated the sum insured, the IBNR using the sum insured or by using the claim count, and you can see that the distribution of those estimates here. So this is the reported claims plus that calculated IBNR. And you can see they're slightly more dispersed than the actual ultimate claims itself, which is what you would expect. The panel on the right then shows you the estimation error of those two methods. So as you can see here, they're unbiased estimates, so they actually the mean is equal to zero. But you can see they're quite dispersed as well, so they don't always exactly equal the actual ultimate claims. And then lastly, the might be a bit hard to see, we've got the black line here, which is the the distribution of the difference between the two estimates. So the two estimates all generally always come out to be different, and that black line is then the difference between those two estimates. And again, a mean of zero, but the standard deviation in here is about 5%. So that's, remember, that's a scheme of about 100,000 lives with 5 years' worth of experience in there. And that's coming out with a standard deviation of 5%. And some companies will use some insured to put into their chain ladder method, and some companies will use claim counts to put into their chain ladder method. So in that situation, those two companies on average will come out with best estimates 5% different, and both estimates will be unbiased. So what we essentially get then is lots of ups and downs in our pricing. They're just small variations from the expected mean. And in a situation where you've got lots of small variations in the expected mean, the normal distribution is generally a pretty good approximation to what's going on. But the question is sort of how wide is that distribution? And in my view, it's certainly greater than 5%. And in the examples I've used previously, I used 10%. And everybody will have their own view of it. I've talked about elements in the that go into parameter risk, but I guess there are also other things that influence the price. One of the papers I referenced to deals with things about cognitive bias, etc. And I thought it actually worthwhile putting the title on the next page, especially if there are any non-actuaries in the room. So there was a paper back in 2000 called Making Actuaries Less Human, which I thought was quite interesting given the reputation that we have. So, as I said, there's lots of things that influence the price up and down, so there's lots of small movements. So here we generally have So outside of parameter risk, there's lots of things that influence it. So we've got things like we've got overconfidence. So generally, people are more confident in their ability than they should be and think they can price more accurately than they actually can. Classic example is if you ask people if they're above average drivers, most will say yes. It's equally as true with experts in their own field. The next two are third-party pressures and confirmation bias. So here as pricing actuaries, we're subject to a lot of external pressures. So when we're looking at evidence presented to us, are we looking for evidence that just increases the price or just reduces the price? Do we place equal weight on all the information we've been given? Is all the information actually presented to us in an unbiased way? If you're dealing with clients, relationship managers, are they actually providing you with all the information? There's an information asymmetry in there. And what happens, and even more subtly, what happens in those 50-50 calls? Do they become 60-40? Do they become 40-60? So all these will actually influence the price further away from the best estimate, or from the expected loss ratio. And then there's market dynamics. So here again, I talked about the information asymmetry. So there is an information asymmetry in there. Are you actually being given all the information? Is information that will increase the price being withheld, etc. There are also built-in options to general risk group life contracts. They can be cancelled at any time, but the rates are guaranteed. Things like profit shares, etc. And also you have multi-round tenders these days, where sort of limited market pricing information is being released, which puts further pressure on the price. So, back to the reference of making actuaries less human. A little graphic up there. So. Okay. Excuse me. So, if insurers are constructing their prices from genuine best estimates and the winner's curse holds, then they should not be achieving their target profit margins. So a rational bidder would distinguish between the best estimate based on the information available and the expected value conditioned on actually winning the tender. So the mere fact that they actually win the tender means that they're at the bottom, would mean they're at the bottom range of that best estimate range. So counterintuitive response to this is that in competitive tenders you should actually increase your margins. Now I know most insurers would probably say they decrease their margins in competitive tenders. So it's sort of the opposite response to what a rational bidder would do. But if insurers are making target profit margins, then we actually need to have a deeper understanding of what's actually going on in the market. There must be something else as well. So this graph has been trotted out a number of times over the last year, and this is one of the reasons why there's actually a lot of focus on group risk. So you can see how from about 2010 onwards, profits have been trending down and even losses made in one quarter there. So these are the APRA quarterly life insurance statistics. But certainly up until December 2010 and sort of prior to 2008, insurers were making reasonable profits on group risk and probably not paying too much attention to the winner's curse at all. But given you can demonstrate it in a fairly simple model, there's certainly something to it. So what else is going on? So I'll go through these quickly. So over the last 20 years, we've had sort of uninterrupted economic growth without a recession. We've had the unemployment has been has been reducing over the last 20 years to near record lows. We've had continuous mortality improvements over those 20 years. Occupational health and safety, if you have a look at workers' compensation rates, claim rates, they've certainly fallen consistently over the last 10 years. Natural conservatism in pricing, etc. And the insurance cycle itself is obviously part of the equation. So these things have all been going on over the last, say, 10, 20 years. And due to that, we've been able to actually make quite healthy profits. But I guess before I leave this slide, sort of a word of warning, don't go back and start putting in full allowances for all of those, because it's probably because of those that we've actually made profits over the last 10, 20 years. So in closing, I'll sum up a few thoughts on what we should be doing going forward. Bid shading is the actual practice of reducing your bid based on the fact that you're in a competitive situation, or increasing your bid in the context of premiums. Some of us may already be practicing this. There are some, one extreme example is not participating in a tender. So you may not participate in a tender because you feel it is too competitive. So that's really a form of bid shading, or just putting in margins because you feel the data's of poor quality, etc. And you know that range that I talked about is going to be very wide. So if you actually win it, there's a good probability that you'll have won it at too low a price. Your own pricing capability. As I've shown, there's a significant disadvantage to an insurer if they have poor pricing capability. I think that's clear to all, but I think it's well demonstrated in the simple model I showed. And similarly, if you have very good pricing capability, then that confers a clear advantage on that insurer as well. They're more likely to, if they win a tender, they're more likely to actually have higher profit margins. Communication and transparency. So you need to properly communicate all the risks clearly to your stakeholders and decision makers, so they can make the correct decisions. Reinsurance. As I said, it's very hard to actually get an idea of what that range of reasonable best estimates is. Utilising reinsurers is one of those ways you can actually get to work out where you are in that reasonable range of best estimates. Control cycle, as I mentioned before, you actually need to go back and look how well your pricing has performed. Are you coming out where you expect to come out based on your pricing? Are you finding you're consistently or pricing is consistently too low? And lastly, don't ignore it. It's actually very hard to do something about this in isolation of other insurers. But if the market as a whole works to increase margins, then it'll happen. Two excellent papers, which I based a lot of this on, are down below. So if you have a spare hour for your CPD, they're definitely recommended reading. The first one is the General Insurance Reserving Task Force. And it's actually very uncanny if you replace general insurance with group risk and valuation with pricing in that paper. It's very, very relevant. And the last is a specific paper on the winner's curse produced in the UK back in 2009. Prior to that, there actually wasn't too much in the insurance literature, but there's more and more that's coming through. So that's a quick run through what's in my paper. So, questions?
Great. Bridget Brown from ANU. Thanks, Colin. I've been intrigued by the winner's curse for some time, actually, and I mainly became interested in it with respect to underwritten annuities in the UK, where I think the main issue is a different opinions, so there's a very wide spread of best estimates. But I was wondering if you had any commentary, or anyone with experience in the Australian market had a commentary on what the rise of online sales of insurance with comparators and so on, aggregators, will have on the winner's curse flowing through to risk takers' bottom lines.
Yeah. So I think you're mostly talking about a retail insurance then. Yes. Yeah. I think, I mean, in retail you definitely get anti-selection. And I think the difference where the retail market is significantly different to the group risk market is a number of areas. Most retail products don't have guaranteed premiums, so you can very easily, if you felt it necessary, adjust those rates. Whereas group risk is subject to a 3-year guarantee generally. And once you're locked in, you're locked in. In retail risk, you're also dealing with a portfolio of business as well. So you're constantly adjusting the premium rates for that portfolio. And you can actually manage it more as a portfolio. Whereas within group risk, I think you're dealing with very large single risks. So, I mean, there's multitude of funds out there with annual premiums over $100 million, whereas retail risks are much smaller, much easier to adjust with. You can adjust the rates at certain ages. You can adjust the loadings here and there. So I think you're less susceptible to it in the retail space.
Hi, Colin. I was just wondering if you had any advice before I go back and tell my boss that we need to price less accurately to win more business.
Well, it's true. There have been people have experienced seeing people sort of significantly underprice and win pick-up schemes when all the other players in the market have thought, well, they've picked that up too low, they're not going to make a profit. It's not always the lowest bid or lowest premiums that will pick up a group risk scheme. But I think it's certainly a very large contribution to who will actually win a tender. So sometimes if you can't very accurately price, sometimes you'll be way out of the market, either above or below, and you risk picking up a scheme and making a loss in that situation.
And the second part of that question was, given we all have a vested interest in having more accurate pricing, do you think there's anything the industry can do as a whole to facilitate that?
I think what the industry is doing at the moment is looking at data in particular, I guess. So the industry is working to get more reliable data to price more accurately, and that's really only just one of the components. I think the other component is probably the education of actuaries themselves in terms of how they go about group risk pricing. So there are a lot of different methods out there, and I don't think we necessarily fully understand them. You look at what some of the general insurance actuaries are doing in terms of IBNRs. They're using stochastic models to work out, get a confidence interval of the IBNR itself. I don't see much of that in general in group risk at the moment. So I think we just need to, in terms of what we're doing at the moment, I think we're working on with data. The Institute of Actuaries is trying to put together Actuaries Institute is putting together an information note on IBNR as well. So that's due to be released sometime this year, which will help educate actuaries. But I think those are probably the two main things. And awareness as well. Yeah.
There's no other questions. I'll do a plant one. How's that? You can't go away. I'm going to ask you. Are you aware, I guess, of how other markets deal with it? I'm using one. Deal with the winner's curse?
So, I mean, there are lots of different markets out there, and they deal with this differently. Probably the one I'd look to first and closest is probably the Lloyd's market. Lloyd's is different to most insurance markets, and that's a subscription market. So what happens there is that you might have a number of insurers come in and price a risk, but it doesn't go for the lowest price. It will go for a combination of, the lowest four prices. So insurers will subscribe to it until it's completed. So the price might be, say, the fourth lowest price rather than the lowest price. So that way you actually get around it always going to the lowest price. I guess others, if you look at other markets, often there'll be clauses in the contract where, like building contracts, for example, if there are expense overruns, if you tender for a building project, if there are expense overruns. Yep. Sometimes there's always get-out-of-jail clauses in those sorts of contracts. But I think group risk to a certain extent is different because it is a three-year guarantee and there's generally no way to break it.
Bruce Vincent, clearly the problem is that it's all based on price. And so from a company point of view, that's not the best place to be. So yeah. I guess we'd wonder, is there any way that this can change? Is there innovative thing whereby maybe there's some experience rating or profit sharing, or to what level does service come in? To what level is sustainable price over not just 3 years but 6 years for large industry funds? So yeah. I guess the challenge is how do we, if possible, make price not 90% of the decision.
Yeah. I think the real world is different to the situation I put up in the presentation. So two examples of that. There are frictional costs in changing insurers. So your stamp duty costs increase if you change insurers. There's always a cost of shifting claims management or underwriting between insurers, etc. So you do have frictional costs in there which do work in the incumbent's favour. But having said that, it probably works against whoever unseats the incumbent, because it means that potentially they're even more biased downwards to actually pull it off them. The other way you can obviously differentiate is through product and service. So I think there's a lot of effort going on by insurers there to differentiate other than price. You also mentioned profit shares. I think the issue with part of the issue at the moment with profit shares is that you actually need the premiums need to be higher to actually pay for that profit share, and there is a reluctance amongst some funds to actually pay for that profit share in the first place. But I think if you can get past that reluctance and able to put through those price rises which could fund those profit shares, then that's definitely a way out as well and would be a solution.
Thanks, Colin. Matt Noyce. Yeah, just a comment, really. I agreed with a couple of your things in terms of what you said about how we can improve as an industry. So one you called out is the data side, and the other is improving our understanding of the risks and educating the actuaries. But I think there's a third as well, and it goes to what you said about the whole thing about bias. And one of the things about bias is the third-party pressure. And I think that it's interesting. what ultimately influences the price that an insurer or reinsurer quotes for a tender is not just the analysis that's been done, but it's a function of a whole bunch of things. And it comes down to the risk management of the organisation, different teams, how well different teams work together, who's done the pricing, who signed off the pricing, what the objectives of different teams are. So all of these things introduce bias. So I guess it's the kind of the softer side of risk management.
Yep, that's right.
So it isn't just about, at the end of the day, what one particular actuary or analyst has come up with the spreadsheet. It's really a function of how well the whole organisation works together and who's made the ultimate decision. And also, I think, the information that's been given to the key decision makers on some of these mega tenders. So, I think it's really interesting. All of those things go into, I guess, in my view, affecting the bias.
Yeah. I mentioned in it my presentation briefly about conservatism. So, I mean, generally, actuaries are a fairly conservative bunch. But I think to a certain extent, actuaries will build in conservatism to actually counter those sorts of external pressures as well. It's almost an automatic response to being pressured to reduce your price as well. So they're counteracting forces, but I think you're right. You do really need to look at your sort of internal governance in terms of pricing to ensure that the pricing actuaries are protected sufficiently from the third-party pressure.
Jeff Humphreys. Thank you, Colin. I've got a couple of points to make. This one is, in my experience, price isn't really the key factor in most of these decisions. And in fact, that the tenders I see, two or three insurers will be at very similar prices. They might all be wrong. I don't think they are wrong necessarily. But it will be decided on the cultural fit with the fund. And it will be decided on things like service levels. How well the fund and that trustee feels they fit in with that insurer. So I think this would be very interesting in a theoretical point of view, but price is not the big criteria at the end of the day for deciding who wins it. Not only that, different insurers have presumably different risk appetites, and one fund will be more attractive to some insurers than other insurers, and might fit better with their total risk for the whole business. So just saying price is the driver of decisions is, I guess, exceptionally simplistic. Yeah. The other problem I've got, which is that we sit here as a bunch of actuaries, effectively we're saying to each other, let's all knock our margins up, and I've got a real issue with that, because I think that sounds to me like price collusion.
just responding to those, I mean, I agree with you, price is not 100%. And it might be 50%, it might be 60%, it might be 80%. It's certainly not 100%. But I do think it is a large part. You talked about insurers being fairly close to each other in terms of price. Similarly, I guess everybody's seen situations where insurers are very far apart in terms of price. And as I said in one of my previous comments, pricing information is generally always being fed back to the market as well. So you might expect that the other insurers will start clustering around that the lowest estimate that's out there, because again they're being fed information that'll reduce the price. I guess the other thing is reinsurers are in a slightly different position as well. Obviously they can't. It's much harder for them to differentiate themselves based on service and other things. So when you talk about number of insurers all being clustered around the same price, it's potentially because they're all being supported by the reinsurer with the lowest price as well. So again, but I mean, I do agree with you, price is not 100%, and what's being put up is overly simplistic, but it's more to demonstrate a principle. So.
Probably just got one more for you, Colin, if no one else has got one. So do you have a view? We've talked about there's a range that we're getting when we get to a tender and so on. What's that? You don't want to ask?
No.
So do you have a view to what, like how wide that range is?
I've used 10% in my presentation, which I feel is a reasonable range. I think the larger the fund, you'd expect a smaller range.
Yeah.
The smaller the fund, you'd expect a larger range. I've talked to a couple of people, someone who said, well, he thinks it'll probably be 15%. Okay. So I guess I'd be interested to hear the views from the floor in terms of what sort of range they think, or what sort of range they think would be reasonable, if anybody has a view.
I don't think it looks like they have a view. So last chance for questions. Last chance for questions.
Well, I'm not going to give you a number.
But come on, Matt.
I'm not going to beat, but I think... just a general comment, I would say that the parameter risk, as you put it in your presentation, has increased massively over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I can't give you a number because it might breach confidentiality, but when I look at some of the range of prices quoted, I actually think that because industry-friendly pricing has become so complex because of changes in design, changes in member choice, there are so many effects to decouple now that I think the parameter risk is actually quite scary.
Yeah.
It's a scary number. That's just my view.
I mean, one area, I guess, people have had experience of parameter risk recently is on LAGIC. In LAGIC, you need to determine a forward risk assumption, and a large component of that is actually parameter risk. It might be worthwhile actually going back and seeing sort of what your valuation team actually came up and measured as your parameter risk through implementing LAGIC. That would be set at roughly about 2.5 standard deviations away, given the 99.5% confidence interval. So if your margin is 25%, you divide that by 2.5, you're looking at 10% parameter risk, essentially. So.
Hey, Colin, Rod Berry. just want to throw in a curly one, I guess. At the end, you put up a number of... points that have explained insurers' past profits, the economy, economic cycle, insurance cycle, etc. Going forward, and I know the Institute is putting out the IBNR paper, all the funds are talking about greater member awareness, there's lots more ads about insurance on TV, etc. Is it in fact possible that the IBNR, underlying IBNR model and pattern itself could change such that actuaries' practice of pricing on past experience may come under threat due to quicker reporting and changes in the IBNR reporting pattern. And I guess just one other curly factor with improved workplace safety, etc., we're talking about obesity and so on, so is there also a threat to a reversal in some of those improved claim trends that we've seen in the past?
Yeah. I think firstly, you forgot to mention lawyers as well. Compensation lawyers are certainly being a lot more active with industry funds, advertising, well, in terms of TPD especially. I think you're right. It sort of points to what Matt was saying about parameter risk is certainly increasing with all the product changes, introduction of choice of cover, etc. A lot of what is held for a while is breaking down to a certain extent, and certainly claim delays are never constant. I think we've probably seen a little bit of acceleration in claims reporting, which feeds through to the IBNR. In terms of mortality improvements, I think. Certainly, if you have a look at the ABS data, there's been no easing off in terms of mortality data. I think 2009 wasn't a particularly good year, but after that, it seems to reemerge. But I think there's definite risk there in terms of things like diabetes and obesity that it could slow down. My personal view is that it'll be a while before it turns the other way.
Are there any more questions from anyone? Or otherwise I'll wrap up since I heard the bell as well. Yeah. So we can start lunch a little bit early. Okay, well, can you join me in thanking Colin for his paper on the tips? Have a look in the wine.
Yeah.
Wine to you over there.